big shout out to you for making it through the hectic holiday season. This new year, get clean, quality, pregnancy nutrient support off your to-do list, including Ritual's best-selling essential prenatal multivitamin, designed with 12 traceable key ingredients to support a healthy pregnancy. With big changes coming up, take the small steps now and start today with 30% off a three-month supply at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Wow. What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Very few of us here are actually mentally ill. I'm not saying you're not mentally ill. For all I know, you're crazy as a loon. But that's not why you're here. That's not why you're here. It's not why you're here. You're here because of the system. There's the television. It's all right there. All right there. Look, listen, kneel, pray. Commercials. Not productive anymore. At least to make things anymore. It's all automated. What are we for then? We're consumers, Jim. Okay, buy a lot of stuff, you're a good citizen. But if you don't buy a lot of stuff, if you don't, what are you then, I ask you? What? Mentally ill. Fact, Jim, fact. If you don't buy things, toilet paper, new cars, computerized blenders, electrically operated sexual devices, stereo systems with brain-implanted headphones, screwdrivers, miniature built-in radar devices, voice-activated computers.
See? Told you. And all the doors are locked, too. They're protecting the people on the outside from us when the people on the outside are as crazy as us.
Do you know what crazy is? Crazy is majority rules. Yeah, There's no right, there's no wrong, there's only popular opinion.
I'm not crazy.
Of course not. You want to escape, right? That's very sane.
Then why don't you?
Why don't I try to escape? That's what you're going to ask me, right? Good question. Very good question. Intelligent. Because I would be crazy to escape. I have sent out word. I am all taken care of.
Nope. That's not Brad Pitt as Tyler Durden in Fight Club, but Brad Pitt as Jeffrey Goines in 12 Monkeys. Directed by Terry Gilliam. Another one of those Gnostic-themed films from the late 90s. Part of that Gen X artistic warning few listen to about the impeding Gnostic nightmare and Philip K. Dick world that came true in the third millennium. Few listen, and here we are at the end of the world and the end of human imagination.
We have been lulled into a trance. They have made us indifferent to ourselves, to others. We are focused only on our own gain.
Like Jeffrey and the Bruce Willis character in 12 Monkeys. They now call us insane and conspiracy theorists and dangerous misfits. They call the Gnostics these very things 2,000 years ago and across history. And along with the witch and the mystic, they burn them in so many ways. And they're trying to burn us today, those of us who listened and have awakened and stand in the battlefield of the true seeker warrior. With hordes of egregores and archons and alien robots named Pandora bearing down upon us.
The world will know that few stood against many.
Well, fuck you and eat crack and shit. All you respectable people. All you societal potentates wanting us to drink your transhumanism Kool-Aid and digital utopia dog food until we become machines.
All that he was, I am, his experience, his knowledge,
but not his wisdom. He may have programmed it, but it could not have given you a soul. You are a machine.
Call us insane all you want and cast us out of your castrati caliphates. We never belonged anyway, and we were destined to transform ourselves with our art, invention, and individuality. We were meant to create better than the creator gods and their butt slaves in the establishment. Help the least of our brothers. As Robert Anton Wilson said, just because I'm crazy doesn't mean I'm wrong. And as the Sufi dictum proclaims, for we are not from the world, and the world is not for us.
We see the world the way it really is, and hope that one day all mankind might see the same.
What is the world, then?
An illusion. One which we can either submit to, as most do, or transcend.
What is it to transcend?
To recognize nothing is true and everything is permitted.
In all this vibe, I love what Jason Louv wrote recently on Twitter. It goes, the universe is already alive and conscious, and all AI infotainment does is trap consciousness in an artificial box so the divine can't get through. The great choice of this century will be between entertainment and ecstasy. Real spiritual practice means taking a neurotic and useless product of modernity and getting them to surrender to the unavoidable pain of existence to the point they can see through their own bullshit and actually begin to see and effectively help other beings.
And now go and make interesting mistakes, make amazing mistakes, make glorious and fantastic mistakes, break rules, leave the world more interesting for your being here. Make good art.
I, your host, Miguel Connor, is with you every step of the way to getting out of this consciousness-trapping box. So welcome to Aeon Bite Gnostic Radio. Shakespeare said hell is closed and all the devils are here. This is true, but in this Red Pill cafeteria, the Pleroma is open and all the Aeons are here with us. Happy heresy, then. Welcome to the desert of the real. Welcome to the virtual Alexandria, and welcome to Aeon Bite. I hope everybody's having a good Saturday and a good weekend. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am still your host and your pompous of Gnosis. And yes, I'm very excited about this show. It's long overdue, and the book we'll be talking is certainly long overdue and a page-turner. I couldn't put it down, and I am so happy to talk to its author. Often, I like to use two quotes that I think are part of the ethos of Aeon Bite. One of them is, I may be crazy, but I'm not wrong. The other one is, reality is anything you can get away with. And those quotes are obviously by the great Robert Anton Wilson. And today it is a pleasure to have Gabriel Kennedy to talk about his book, Chapel Perilous, the biography of Robert Anton Wilson. Gabriel, thank you very much for coming on Aeon Bite.
Hi, Miguel. Thank you for having me here. That was a very kind introduction. And hi, Vance. How are you doing today?
Yes, Vance. You've left okay. The Overlook Hotel. You escaped after our show on Stanley Kubrick. Now you're somehow in a different reality tunnel, right?
That's right. I'm in Chapel Perilous.
There you go. We all should be there. And God knows this age is one collective Chapel Perilous. And we'll certainly get into that in this show. So for everybody, I see everybody in the chats. Good to see everybody. Good to see you, Mike Frank, Black Evil, Texas Magi Dude. Yeah, we got some Discordians and at least ethos all in the chat room. As always, if you have any questions or complaints against Vance or I, please super chat them so we can get to them. And there's a lot to cover, so we should definitely get into it. So first of all, why don't we start with you, Gabriel? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into Raw.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Gabriel Kennedy. These days, I pretty much describe myself as a, a multimedia artist, you know, concentrating on the written word, visual art, acting, and music. I've written before this book, which is my first book, Chapel Perilous, Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. Before writing this book, I've, you know, written a series of articles for different online websites and magazines like Boing Boing, Mondo 2000, my own sites, Reality Sandwich, etc. I was in the world of music for a number of years, both within sort of like the New York and kind of global hip hop scene, producing work and visual art, and then also in sort of like the rock music scene. And then was always writing, though. I discovered the work of Robert Anton Wilson in high school, my senior year, read Illuminatus trilogy, and it sort of became like a Bible of sorts. It became my go-to book, and Wilson sort of became my sounding board in many ways as years developed. After Illuminatus, I read Cosmic Trigger Volume 1 and Prometheus Rising, and those two books pretty much set me on a track to want to read more of Wilson and discover more of his work. And at the time, he was still alive. So that was exciting, you know, to find a living writer that was really inspired by and touching on the writers that I had read before him, people like Henry Miller and Friedrich Nietzsche. And but these people were dead. And here was this person, you know, carrying the torch, if you will. And I was very interested in then meeting him and seeing, you know, what the guy was like, but that would not be for many years later. And that was in 2003 when I met Wilson after the premiere of his Maybe Logic, after the premiere of a documentary that was based on his life called Maybe Logic, The Lives and Ideas of Robert Anton Wilson. It was in Santa Cruz. And I interviewed him the next day, and that sort of was the beginning of this book in many ways. Like, that was the seeds of this book, because shortly after that interview, he started the Maybe Logic Academy, which was his online asynchronous remote learning website that he started with the director of Maybe Logic. So together they formed this amazing online website that's 20 years ahead of the curve. I mean, most major colleges, especially during COVID, they began using this asynchronous remote learning format. I mean, it's almost exactly the same. There are forums, modules, weekly modules, et cetera, et cetera. And so Wilson started this site in 2004, and he was there till his death in 2007. So for those 3 years, I took almost all of his classes and workshops. And he brought in other awesome thinkers, like people like, Douglas Rushkoff, Eric Davis, Starhawk, Peter Carroll, Reverend Ivan Stang, David J. Brown. The list goes on and on. It was like an all-star cast of amazing, thinkers and writers at this time when it was a totally different era now of the internet, which is very interesting because Wilson died, shortly before the emergence of the iPhone, which, the iPhone introduces the world that we're in today. You know, Wilson was the kind of last breath of the techno-utopianist vision for the internet, where it could be used as a collaborative tool to make everybody smarter and more intelligent. And I like to think that Maybe Logic Academy was such a place for the most part. And so after he died, I kind of just, took it on myself to go deeper in learning his work. And this whole thing sort of emerged organically. It started out as this book started out as a book about his ideas, but then I kind of wanted to put a spine together to chart the development of his ideas through time, because Wilson's like any dynamic thinker, he's moving through many different phases. And just to contextualize his work, like, so for instance, Cosmic Trigger Volume 1, you read about this guy who's moving all the time, but he's doing all this wild interior research that's like, how can you stay grounded when you're doing all that stuff and you're doing all this acid on top of it, you know? And that book was so inspiring, not to say that it inspired anyone to do a bunch of acid and magic, but more so how to stay grounded if you find yourself in those states, right? And so, you know, just being again, him pretty much becoming my favorite writer, the book became the final lesson, if you will, of how to really understand his work. You know, I learned that from Wilson and many great teachers, is the best way to learn a subject is to teach a class or to produce something about it. So this is all really an attempt to go further in understanding his work. But, you know, when I started writing the biography, I took it very seriously and I wanted to do a really proper job of it. And I wanted to, you know, really do a bang up job in terms of research and compile some things that have not been compiled yet. And I think I really did that in this book. So, from my work personally to working on this book, it was just all an organic trajectory. So, and the book really became everything else that I did, any other sort of art that I practiced, like really went by the wayside through many phases of writing this book. This book just became my constant. It became my life raft in many ways. So,
oh, I know the feeling. It's like you're possessed. As Jung says, you don't pick ideas. Ideas pick you. And yeah, it's wonderful. You have a foreword written by Grant Morrison, which of course I was like, ooh, that's great. And this is the only bio of Robert Anton Wilson, right? I know Eric Davis in his book High Weirdness, but that's like three. He does Robert Anton Wilson, Terrence McKenna, and Philip K. Dick. But this is the only dedicated bio.
Correct. Yes, this is the first, and as Ralph Metzger calls it, the definitive biography of Wilson. You know, because I was able to get source material, like interviewing people who were with Bob, who, you know, I don't know if anyone's working on a biography right now, but some of these people might not be here. No. You know, and some of them passed away throughout the course of writing the book, like Paul Krasner and Antoro Ali, who I was lucky enough to both interview. And, you know, they passed on. So, yeah, it's the first biography.
Yeah, it's almost surprising. But then again, who Robert Anton Wilson is to you, Philip K. Dick is to me, the sort of that red pill moment, but there's only a handful and I was surprised, but such is the world. Well, let's talk about your book, because again, it was a page turner and there were so many new dimensions that I learned about, and you address everything, even, was he a CIA plant? You have that, you have everything. It's not like you're writing a puff piece. You really say, this is the man, and I'm standing there objectively writing about his life. So the first question is the world that created Wilson. How did he become Wilson? I think people forget about the silent generation, which he was part of, which people like Bob Dylan, Philip K. Dick, Elvis, Martin Luther King, Noam Chomsky. There's this generation like Gen X that kind of got forgotten, but he was part of it, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, and that's a fine group of people, right? The silent generation, for sure. He was born in 1932 in Brooklyn, in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and, you know, raised by pretty much first generation American parents. Bob's grandparents, you know, his father's side was from Ireland and his mother's side was from Trieste. And his parents both grew up in Brooklyn. When Bob was about 4 years old, around that age, the impact of the Great Depression finally affected his family. It had been since the Great Crash in 1929, you know, sweeping through the nation and America just getting more and more poor. So the Wilsons moved from Flatbush to a little bungalow community in the South Shores of Brooklyn, like South Brooklyn, dirt roads and everything, no buses, no trains, no anything, a place called Garrison Beach. And it's like a small little kind of plot of land, sort of on like the you know, the marshland, if you will, if there is that in the north shores of, excuse me, the south shores of that, you know, Long Island landmass. And yeah, it was there that Wilson sort of got his first taste of hard reality. You know, he described how at the time there were many, he didn't even have the vaccine, the polio vaccine, when he contracted polio at the age of two. His mother, luckily enough, found a, and what is now considered an alternative therapy, the Sister Kenny method, which, you know, kind of flew in the face of medical experts at the time, who, when there was no vaccine for polio, which is a virus contracted from, you know, a fecal matter in water. So, you know, that's all a product of poor infrastructure and bad, you know, municipal plumbing and whatnot, you know. And so, so many kids contracted this and did not have the polio cure or vaccine, Wilson being one of them. But as I said, the Sister Kenny method involves stretching oneself, stretching one's muscles, pushing basically the body, which was the complete opposite of what medical experts were telling his mother, for instance, which was that children should be immobilized and basically stop moving if they have this polio. And so Wilson pretty much always had polio for the rest of his life, but through these techniques and stuff, he was able to sort of maintain and manage the inflammation. Yet he always had things going on with his feet and his legs. He always talked about being about 20 degrees colder than you know, most people usually. And him being a silent generation, that's a great way to describe it, because he really sought to keep, I mean, as best as he could, his complaints about his pain as quiet as possible. And, you know, some people try to do that and some people think they do that, but they don't realize how passive aggressive they become, you know, like, but Wilson, maybe through, honestly, he'd say it when he discovered like marijuana and LSD, like, these two things were very medicinal for him. And then, you know, magic, but which he later describes pretty much as like creative visualization or self-hypnosis. Him learning those techniques as well, how to manage his pain, et cetera, et cetera. So I say all that to illustrate, Wilson grew up in a very hard environment. And Garrison Beach today, which I had the privilege of going to Garrison Beach after I got the book deal. It's kind of a little spiritual journey to pay homage to the man, you know what I mean? Okay. And, it's a one road town still in the south, the last exit to Brooklyn, as one book is titled. It really is like that. Still no train goes there and buses go there, obviously. But, so Wilson came from this environment, and sadly, there was not a lot of nutrition in terms of his intellect when he told his parents that he wanted to be a writer. He wrote his first novel, he said, I think at the age of 12 or something, or 14. It's called The Age of Miracles. And he wanted this guy Danny Kaye to be in the movie, or he wanted a movie adaptation of it as well. So he had big dreams right from the jump, right? But his parents quickly told him, like, you're not of the class that is allowed to have these dreams. We're poor, Bob. Like, the only thing that we get if we try to become writers is we get to starve to death. So if you want that, you could go for it, but it's not going to bode well for you. So Wilson's first mission, he had two early missions in life. The first one was to get out of Catholic school, because it was torturous. And he didn't want to go on to Catholic high school, which sounded even more torturous. And getting out of Catholic school was easier than convincing his parents that he wanted to be a writer. But he did it in one fell swoop by taking the test and gaining admittance into Brooklyn Technical, which is an illustrious high school. It's still a very seen in high regard for science and whatnot. So luckily, Wilson's mind, he was able to really, you know, pull himself up truly by his bootstraps in many ways through the use of his intellect. His physical body was limited because of, you know, stricken with the polio. And but he went to Brooklyn Tech and from there, his kind of world opened up a lot. And he was a precocious youth. If you know, we are to believe what he wrote about how many books he read in high school by himself, you know, kind of as an autodidact, It's pretty astounding and phenomenal. You know, like you mentioned Noam Chomsky. I know that, you know, Chomsky as a kid was reading insane amounts of books and writing all these things. And, you know, to imagine that there were a number of these young people like this walking around Brooklyn who did not come from fancy upbringings, yet they were sort of genius. I mean, they are geniuses, truly. So I think to me, that's inspiring to hear Wilson's beginnings and to see what he was able to do with himself with very little help or support from many places, and especially his parents. Like, that's the first one.
They don't understand us kids. Yes, yes. So yeah, you had the Depression, you had the World War II, then you had the insane post-war American empire. I mean, it was, yeah, this generation had a lot to go through. But again, through his life, and it seemed Wilson was very eclectic. He was very open-minded, like you said, very bookish. I'm going to read about this and that, whether it could be Crowley or the Mayans, that sort of eclectic occultism. But what I got, and of course, please correct me, is that he was one of the few who really, he was almost hermetic or Gnostic. He understood that the final frontier wasn't space. There was nothing, not the bottom of the ocean, because there's only water, as the talking head said, but the final frontier was the human mind. That's what could create any reality. That was the magic. But the powers that be could control that and create false reality. So again, when you look at what really gave him passion, from Wilhelm Reich to Carl Jung, I mean, isn't it, do you agree with that, that he really was a psychonaut? He thought, this is where it's at, as a human mind.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, he, and that eclecticism as well. Where exactly does that originate? I think that was one of the questions that I had while writing the book, especially his early years. Mm-hmm. And I think he was just drawn to writers and thinkers that also were drawing together all these different seemingly disparate things. Like so it could go run the gamut from, you know, Buckminster Fuller to James Joyce, Ezra Pound. But philosophically, like, I think what really like was an early undercurrent to his thinking and his whole approach the rest of his career was that book Science and Sanity. So written by Alfred Korzybski, and was published in 1933, and Bob came across it in you know, New York library when he was, as he said, the age of 16. And and this book is a, you know, a true door stopper. It's a, you know, it's a brick. You know, and it's 800 plus pages. And Korzybski was under the, you know, the firm belief that people needed to clarify our language to the point of, like, to make it as solid as calculus, right? Mm. So Korzybski was what is pretty much termed now a linguistic determinist, right? So the words we use and how we use them have a large influence, if not determine the way that we think about the world. And if we can't describe something, then we can never even imagine it, you know, or we can never truly visualize it. We can have an inkling of a vision in our head, but we need the tools of these words that we utilize, et cetera, to really manifest or maximize this vision. And so, Korzybski's, again, like as simply as possible, like his, you know, and his approach that gets later called general semantics. And there's a whole school that's formed around this Korzybski's approach, which in many ways is sort of about evolving the use of our language to make it match current science. So, you know, as we utilize non-Newtonian physics to create things like computer screens and TVs, and now we're in the world of quantum computing, like, we also need to utilize non-Aristotelian forms of thought. Like, and that's pretty much how we make sense of things, you know, like, you know, Aristotle's excluded middle, right? Which, you know, zeroes in on what Korzybski called the is of identity, which essentially applies an essential quality to a person, place, or thing. But, you know, this being the raging debate back to Heraclitus, that one can never step in the same river twice because of the flux of movement of reality. So very, very simply put, Korzybski's presenting a, you know, process philosophy, which, you know, I guess the academic term is today, one which, you know, also Alan Watts utilizes. And that's pretty much the fact that, you know, we're in non-simultaneous, you know, networks of constant change and rotation and cyclical movement, as opposed to these sort of linear progressions, you know, one object through empty space to another object. So this blew Bob's mind when he first read Science and Sanity at the age of 16. It answered this, you know, raging question that he had, as a lot of young people have at that age, perhaps. And that was, what is reality? Right. Really, when we look at it, come on, like, what are we talking about here? Like, because Bob was a young, inquisitive mind. Like, he used to say that the neighbors used to call him, like, they said he should have been a lawyer, because so he was young and quite loquacious. Right. He was probably super inquisitive and just asking all these questions all the time. This is pure speculation, but I imagine that he had a very patient father who was able to really give him some nice grounded explanation of things. And that perhaps was a nice emotional stability through his young life of a lot of tumultuous events and whatnot, both outside of him and going on, you know, locally or whatever. So this kind of general semantic undercurrent matched with Wilson being a product of the 20th century and now including all these changing communication technologies, you know, from the radio being in his house at the age of six to then later a TV, et cetera, as things morph and change and film and whatnot. Wilson is aware of, you know, how fast things are starting to change around him. Right. And so he's that, I think, adds to this eclectic nature, right? Like this, you know, if things lose an essential quality and things become a lot more existential, like you are yourself in relation to the people and the places that you are in, not so much you have this, you know, essential quality. So I think his eclecticism is him being a product of his time and him being very aware of what was going on throughout the 20th century through technological development and scientific development and really across the board. He was, as I said in the book, he was an early warning radar system. He was just, his mind was just, all the windows were open, you know, the channels were on.
Exactly. I would agree. And at the same time, some people have talked to, well, he was just a thinker, but he was also an individual who had certain experiences of the numinous, right? Not just sometimes on drugs, but sometimes he had premonitions, he had visions. I mean, he saw behind the veil at times.
I think that was like an area that he was seeking to really explore and forward, especially in the, you know, the mid 70s and what is pretty much encapsulated in Cosmic Trigger Volume 1. I guess the metaphors that he used for that exploration into that realm would, you know, was more the thelemic, a little bit of the Jungian, and of course, you know, a transpersonal psychological bent. Wilson, but to go to zero in quicker on your question there about psychedelic experiences of the numinous, as you put it, like, at the age of 18, he, this could have been his first experience with what maybe he called a Satori or a mini Satori, which is a Japanese term for like a sudden enlightenment. He described it as just kind of walking along one day on the street. But he described it sort of in Kurt Vonnegut terms of, you know, becoming unstuck in time.
Right.
And, I think the main character from Slaughterhouse-Five became, and which is very interesting. Like, this is Wilson's sort of first experience of the numinous, has this, you know, theme, if you will, of time. And this becomes a major area of sort of exploration for him. It's not pronounced throughout his work. However, I shouldn't say it's overly explicit in it. It's not overly explicit in his work, but it's there. Is that, especially you see it in Cosmic Trigger Volume 1, that when he goes to these places, these entities are babbling what he seems to be, thinks is gibberish. But later on, he you know, puts it together that they're trying to tell him things about time. So that's an interesting parallel. I mean, to kind of go off on a tangent a bit, I mean, you mentioned Grant Morrison earlier. That's an area where Morrison has explored a lot too, especially in, you know, the comic book, The Invisibles, that great comic book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This sort of theme that comes up, I guess, in psychedelic explorations, that why time, the question of time keeps coming up. And, you know, back to Wilson, he had that in the psychedelic state, but again, it also at the age of 18, totally sober. I guess for him, peeling back the veil involved like seeing through the illusion of time or something like that, you know.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
That's a good way to put it. Again, there are many more. I don't know if you want to talk about his suicide attempt when he... That really shifted his life. The other one I could not get through that stayed with me, Gabriel. Oh, and by the way, Nameless is the best Grant Morrison graphic novel. Nobody read it but me, but it's still my favorite, and I will die on that hill. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But the one that stuck with me, and it's almost tragic, and it made me frustrated about being a human, was the one where he had a premonition about his son, Graham, going to die. And he was freaking out, and what happened was his other daughter, poor Luna, was murdered not too after that. It's like, you know, when the communication comes out and we never get it right, you know what I mean? Our premonitions are off. But that one was heartbreaking because, again, her death and then later Graham's schizophrenia, of course, were huge events in his poor life.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say those are sort of the two most dramatic parts of Wilson's adult life, I suppose, like in the most horrible way possible, right? And I think, I mean, in early October 1976, Bob's 15-year-old daughter, Patricia Luna Wilson, was murdered at her after-school job. Which was just a mere 10-minute walk from their house in Berkeley, California. And it was a vintage clothing shop, and it was set a little deeper in the row of stores. So there was sort of some kind of homeless people that hung out, or maybe people who were addicted to drugs and whatnot. It was a sort of a dangerous sort of spot in a way, but Luna was a strong girl. Bob talked about that a lot, and she had a great charm and people liked being around her. However, a person came in that on when she was at work that one afternoon and basically brutally murdered her in a seeming robbery where the assailant took $50 from the register and brutally murdered Luna. Yeah. So this was preceded by, however, what you spoke about, Wilson having like a precognitive sort of vision of, or voice really, during I guess it was a yeah, kind of pagan, you know, it was with the, I think it was, he was with the new reformed Orthodox order of the Golden Dawn. It was a ritual that they were all doing. And this was like, you know, a Bay Area sort of conglomeration of pagan hippies, like doing some fun stuff. And, you know, Wilson and Arlen, his wife, you know, they hung out with them and stuff. And, they were doing a ritual called the Cone of Power, ritual, which was, you know, seeking to focus this sort of conical energy up above everyone's heads. And you could then direct that energy if you put an intention in mind. And that was another vision. Bob had a few visions. That was another vision that Bob had of Graham when they're doing a Cone of Power ritual. That was in 1974. The one that what he experienced in 1976, excuse me, before the death of Luna, was he was speaking at an event and then sharing the stage with an artist who, Jean Millay, I believe her name was, and a man named Tim Scully, who was actually, I guess, the inventor of orange sunshine acid, who also then later got into developing computers. And she built like an art installation piece, but was really geared towards, it was sort of a mind machine, if you will, like a neural feedback, sort of biofeedback thing. And Wilson spoke about how it, you know, biofeedback machines will put one in or neural feedback machines will put one in different brainwave states, alpha, beta, et cetera, brainwave states. And Wilson entered a certain brainwave state, right? He determined, and then he heard a voice, and it was Graham's gonna die. Right. Something like that. And then after that, you know, he was spooked, and then he did all these, you know, prayers and, you know, visualizations to protect Graham and protect everyone in his family. And then shortly after, Luna was murdered. And then Graham, to make matters worse, shortly after that, had a schizophrenic breakdown and then as Christina, one of the other, of Bob and Arlen's daughters, told me, sort of really was a stressful event, tore a tenuous thread of the family apart, as she described it. And Wilson, I mean, that's some of the hardest sort of, I guess, parapsychological information one can receive. And then the added pain in feeling like you got it wrong. You know, that I don't know what one could do. I mean, however, and then this gets into the realm of, like, you know, parenting, which I am not a parent, and I'm not going to speak on that, you know, like, other than it, from all, you know, and everything that I read and heard about them, was Bob loved his kids very much, and this tore him apart. And, you know, but he, you could say, you know, he carried on and he kept writing, and he used his art and his writing to work through a lot of really hard emotions. And you could see that in his fantastic book, Schrodinger's Cat Trilogy. Mm-hmm. This book, it's three books, of course, and it's such a great, fantastic discussion of three theories of quantum physics that he was fascinated with, you know, like Bell's theorem, or, you know, quantum entanglement, the many worlds theory, some other thing. And he also filtered all of this hard feeling and emotion and all the shame that he felt, like the real stuff now, like not just Bob, this fantastic, fun kind of superhero sort of thinker, right? Like, it's like Bob, like the very humble guy walking through life, that like has to sit with the fact that he felt like he let his daughter die brutally, and then watched his son, you know, really kind of lose his mind. And at the time when Luna was murdered, you know, Bob was friends with like this sort of first generation life extension culture that was developing in Berkeley at the time. So he knew people that worked at cryogenic cryogenics, right? Right. Yeah, like yeah. This, he was in the cryogenic scene, if you will. And that was a big thing at the time, a growing intellectual trend in Berkeley. And so there was a facility called Trans Time Cryogenics, where they offered to take Luna's brain because her body was too damaged, to sort of cryogenically freeze it in the hope that perhaps one day, you know, DNA sequencing and cloning or whatever. Bob both really believed in life extension and the possibility of cryogenics, but you know, this was also his way of dealing with the sudden death. But he always made it a point to say that he still really firmly believed in cryogenics. So that's one response that he had to this tragic event. But I try to get all of this in there at that time, that mm-hmm. time frame. That's sort of like peeling back the veil and the death of his child. Like, he had other visions after that, but sadly that was like, he was having all these wild visions, and that was a very difficult grand opus to receive. And
yeah, indeed, it's something else. And again, your book details so many of his other visions. He was certainly a mystic. Again, I don't know what I want to call his metaphysics. I think maybe Eric Davis is right. He just calls it high weirdness for this second part of the 20th century, when you have this mixture of mysticism and science and ufology and quantum physics and entheogens, and you throw it together and you get people again, Terence McKenna, Wilson, Philip K. Dick, David Bowie. You know, it's kind of, call them psychonauts, because again, they believe that unlocking the powers of the mind is how we get out of this. But anyway, I'm just playing with ideas, Gabriel. But I want to bring in Vance. Vance, do you have a question about Robert Anton Wilson for Gabriel?
Yeah.
I'm going to let the Schrodinger's cat out real quick. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Could you say that cosmic trigger was his response to his daughter's death? That's the way I remember it, having read it many years ago. It was a lot about the death of his daughter, and he brought, you know, Aleister Crowley into it and so forth. There was a lot going on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was definitely one response to I think kind of really help him cope. I think that Bob really utilized art as self-therapy, and his writing as such, although he would layer it with other things like great thoughts. So it wouldn't be the first thing that you would really pick up was like, oh wow, this guy's really grieving and he's using this writing as a way to kind of, you know, feel better from tragedy, because his mind was so expansive. And so cosmic trigger is a response to the death of his daughter, but it's also, you know, material that he was working on for many years before then as well. It's a bit of a cut and paste of some other books at the time that did not get published that now have been posthumously published, like this book called The Starseed Transmissions, which Bob wrote, he said, and like he told his friend Greg Hill in 3 weeks. And it was all about Timothy Leary and why Timothy Leary should be freed from prison. But that book didn't end up getting published during Bob's life. So what he did was, he would take little bits of that and put it in Cosmic Trigger, et cetera, et cetera. Bits of his articles. So yeah, Bob was a dedicated everyday 9 to 5 or sometimes way more hours at the desk at a typewriter, typing away in the classic sense of a writer, as we used to think about him, you know, from typewriter to then later Mac keyboard. But, from Crowley to the exploration of the Illuminati in Cosmic Trigger. Wilson was as Peter Carroll said, like he had a jet engine mind, right? And he was so able to just take all these widely disparate, seemingly unrelated things and just like pull them all together and weave a very consistent, flowing narrative explaining and unpacking all of these jargonized terms and philosophies and sciences. So I think he did that in Cosmic Trigger as well. Like, he was, you know, a public intellectual of the stoner intelligentsia of the underground American, you know, counterculture.
Love it.
You know, that's why he's so important.
Yeah, yeah. The conflict there, an oxymoron almost, stoner intellectual.
Yeah, exactly. And what would you say were, for the audience, his politics? Surprising nobody, I would agree with Wilson 90% of his politics.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting about Bob is that this is one reason why I wrote the book. I wanted to chart on a graph, essentially, through space and time, like where he sat on the political spectrum, you know, from left to right and whatnot. And this is why Bob is so great, because just like he would present conspiracy theories and then present political theories, he also presented an analytical meta-analysis of all these theories, an anthropological query as to, well, why do we even have political parties to begin with? Why do human beings even think like this? You know, and the whole idea of the left-right, political spectrum came about from the French Revolution, right? Where, you know, those who were with the king sat on the left side, those who weren't sat, or vice versa, right? Those who were with the king sat on the right side, et cetera, et cetera. But so Bob, in his writing, always expressed a dedicated desire to transcend this left-right paradigm. And in that respect, a very illustrative article and great article to read if you want to learn more about this is an article called, I think it's like Beyond Left and Right, or I have it right here. It's in my book, and it's called, I think it's called, yeah, Beyond Left and Right, A Non-Euclidean Perspective. So really beginning in the 70s, in the mid 70s, Wilson hopped on this notion that we have to get beyond this left and right divide. And one way to do it is to focus on going into outer space. Mm-hmm. I charted this in my book. So there's what Wilson writes, and then there's how Wilson lived as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, even though he would describe himself perhaps at times as, an agorist, you know, which in 1971 he told Israel Regardie that he was an agorist, which is might sit more on the right side of the libertarian spectrum. Wilson consistently, statistically, acted as a left libertarian. If there's a definition, I mean, in 1992 he even voted, right? So this was a person. Right. Like, you know, in the early 60s, Wilson described himself, you know, he dedicated himself to anarchism after coming across Peter Kropotkin's book, Mutual Aid. And then he went to an early sort of intense period of learning about individual American anarchists, anarchism, et cetera. And he became dedicated to like this egoist anarchism, atheism, an atheistic sort of approach. But his experiences through the 70s, he softens his tone of calling himself like a kind of raving anarchist. Cause in the late 60s, he was working at Playboy, but was the most politically active that he'd ever been in terms of on the street protesting and organizing peace demonstrations. And he was in various anarchist organizations and whatnot. But he, as I said, though, like by the mid 70s, his perspective is towards, he calls it like Upland. There was a book called Upwingers, which was written by this individual who who spoke about basically the same thing, that humans needed to evolve beyond this left-right political divide. So I think that was part of the sale of libertarianism at the time as well. I think it was sort of being presented as like, this will get people beyond this left-right divide because, you know, the civil liberties of the traditional left, but like a fiscal application of sort of more traditional right, you know, perspectives towards economics. But Bob was focused in the mid 70s of getting Tim Leary out of jail and going to outer space. My point in all of this is that Bob never voted Republican in his life. When he did vote in 1992, he voted for Clinton. He later regretted that. He said that, you know, a friend convinced him to vote for him. But he did like the fact that Bill Clinton was a fan of this book called Non-Zero by Robert Wright. And ultimately, Wilson finally lands on this place where he wanted limited government. Like, he liked minarchy. This is at the end of his life. But he was an individualist anarchist of the collectivist bent, meaning there's an oxymoron, but meaning an individual cannot be fully free, like, unless like he's around fully free people. And, you know, a fully free society can't be fully free unless everyone is fully free, right? So we have to work together to support each other's individual freedom. As simple as that sounds, it's much harder to accomplish. So by the end of his life, Bob was back to describing himself as an anarchist again, though. You know, his time in Europe made him very interested in you know, going beyond, you know, Republican Democrat parties, obviously. But yeah, he died an anarchist.
Good man. Good man. Good to hear that. And in keeping in line with the show, obviously it's no secret that the spiritual patrons of the show, well, beyond Elvis, is Philip K. Dick and Carl Jung. And your book goes into detail about Jung and his interest in Jung. And then, but there's also this great passage about his meeting with Philip K. Dick, which I thought was just invaluable. Can you tell the audience about that?
Sure. Yeah. The first and only time Bob and Philip K. Dick met each other was in, I believe it was 1978 at a science fiction conference that Bob's friend Scott Appel brought Bob to. And Scott was also good friends with Philip K. Dick. So he introduced them together at like a hotel room party where, you know, things get really wild at the sci-fi hotel room parties. You know, Philip K. Dick, like, I'm not quite sure how they, you know, first, you know, sat down talking, but the way Bob describes it, Phil K. Dick just was like just asking him all these questions about his experiences during the Cosmic Trigger years. So one, Phil K. Dick was very aware of Bob's work, and he was, you know, like almost obsessed with Wilson's own experiences. And you know, Bob noted that a tone of the questioning, though, was so, of course, you know, Phil K. Dick had, as I'm sure you explored in the show, like a reverse amnesia where he remembered, you know, that, you know, the empire never fell and, you know, we're living in 70 AD. And he saw similarities to what he had, to what the experiences Bob had when Bob was questioning the role of Sirius in his far out experiences. But so Bob noticed that Philip was almost seeing how sane Bob seemed, how with it he seemed, because
of all people to judge,
right? Because somehow, like, if Bob seemed grounded and together, well, then Phil was going to be okay, right? And of course, both had such tremendous humor. I'd imagine there was a lot of laughing and jokes, and I think that's one thing that's not known too well about Philip K. Dick, was like how funny he seemed to be, like with people, like
a prankster.
Yes. And that was the first and only time that they seem to have met. But along the way, Philip K. Dick provided a blurb though for Wilson, and a very glowing blurb about his work. So I'd say he was a fan of Bob's work.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, they had different cosmogonies and cosmologies for their worldviews, but so it would have been seen how it got there. You want to say something, Russ?
Yeah, this is a good time since you mentioned Scott Appel, and I actually went to see Robert Anton Wilson and Scott Appel at a San Jose science fiction convention in the early 90s. And the thing I remember the most about it, and this is what I'm going to ask you about, he seemed contemptuous of us because after he gave his little spiel at the end, he just got up and turned his back on us all, and he felt contemptuous, didn't say goodbye, everybody, thanks for coming or anything. He just got up and like walked out.
Gabriel's book answers this too.
Yeah. Miguel
American audiences.
Right.
Rod did not like American audiences.
Yeah. What could you tell us about that?
Well, yes. I put in the book that I guess Bob, generally preferred, I guess, the European audiences to American audiences. However, especially at that time, 1990, I think that's just this book presents warts and all, right? Like, in some ways, I guess the description of Bob was that he could be very aloof.
Oh yeah.
And, he did, he experienced a lot of social anxiety, as did Philip K. Dick. Mm-hmm.
He'd say, let's get out of here. That's what he told Scott. I'll never forget that. And it's a shame because I loved, Cosmic Trigger and the Illuminatus, and I was there to see him. And all of a sudden, somebody that I'd kind of admired, like turned his back on me, just get out of here.
Oh, wow. That's an unfortunate experience. And that's one that,
like I said, Vince, if you only had a cup of tea and spoke with an English accent.
I say,
come on.
Could you come back here?
I would just put this in, that was Bob's shadow, right? I mean, Bob could be a jerk. And I think that was probably Bob just being a jerk to his fans right there at that time. 1990, let me see. He had just sort of, he was just, he was in the Bay Area at that time, just kind of getting back from Europe after some years there. But I don't know. I mean, he, in the book, I write about how his opinion of American audiences at times were not too high. Over the years, that I'd say that definitely softened though. And he became, more and more open to people. But read the book and see how he did that. Right. Sadly people can be jerks sometimes, and I have no, I'm not going to try to, I was, Bob was a dick sometimes, and Bob was a dick. You got to call him a dick.
Yeah. The humans are flawed. I also love the part, really beautiful in your book, bringing in Jung. You talk about when James Joyce came with his daughter Lucia, who had problems, and Jung treated her and told James Joyce, she's schizophrenic, and he's all broken. He said, look, sometimes when, and James Joyce is like, she must have gotten it from me, that creative, crazy, wild energy. And Jung was like, what happened? And Jung was like, yeah, sometimes when people go down into the waters of the unconscious, one of them drowns and one of them comes out. It's the old saying by Joseph Campbell, the mystic swims where the psychotic drowns. So that's a beautiful story, which it always says, there are no guarantees, right? Once, whether you take some entheogens or you go down into the mystic world, there's always a risk that your mind's not going to come back.
That's
nobody's safe.
Yeah, heck yeah, Miguel.
I mean, look at Sid Barrett. Look at so many. We could come up with a million examples. Look at people who, end their careers like Crowley, addicted to drugs and broken. Alan Watts ended up an alcoholic at the, you know, there's no guarantees when you take this journey into Chapel Perilous, right?
No guarantees. That's very true. And Bob relates that story of James Joyce going to Carl Jung to try to help his daughter, Lucia, which is a true story. And Bob puts that in his book, The Masks of the Illuminati, which was published, I think, in 81 or 82. And this was another book that Bob poured his emotions into in kind of covert sort of ways. Like he was guarded like that still, even in his fiction. But he it's when you unlock the code, as I did in doing his biography, and then seeing how much of his personal life that he put into his fiction, even just characters and locations, it's so much fun to see. He describes the scene in Masks of the Illuminati, because James Joyce is a character in it, in his book, and as is Carl Jung. And this is Wilson's guarded way, I believe, of letting out and talking about his own Graham's struggles with schizoaffective disorder. Mm-hmm. Bob never mentions this ever in any of his work. He never talks about Graham's illness. I saw Graham in 2003 when I was in Santa Cruz to watch the documentary, Maybe Logic. He looked just like Bob. I was like, I did a double take. I was like, what? Who is that? That's Bob. That's Bob. And basically in Bob's writing, it's you get that Graham wanted to be a physicist and a mathematician. And so sadly, Graham was very much affected by schizophrenia. And I truly believe, you know, he writes about Joyce's grieving in that book. And this is Bob, right, channeling and using the art to let this and release this a little bit. And you know, it's strange. Like there's a couple directions one could go here. Like when Bob goes to Ireland, after he and Arlen go there in 1982, they'd been living with Graham, and it had just been the three of them. And they had a nice high rise apartment in Park Merced, San Francisco. Bob's finally making some money with his writing, after years of poverty. And sadly, Graham has these outbursts that are very self-destructive and, kind of life-threatening. And, Bob and Arlen are just blown out by the end of everything, right? Even Kerry Thornley comes back into the fold and he's scaring the heck out of Bob and Arlen. Bob's thinking that Kerry might pop out of the bushes and shoot him coming out one day when he's doing this. And then Reagan got elected and Bob and Arlen were like, yuck, we gotta get out of here, you know? And then someone, a neighbor of theirs, was murdered in Park Merced, 1982, right? And then, so they go to Ireland and they sort of leave Graham with Christina and Alex, the two other children. And during their time in Ireland, Bob pretty much reads a few books and.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.